Hello, this is Terrence McNally. I intend to record a new show at least every 2 weeks, but was out of the country and unable to do so this week. Instead, you'll hear my June 2013 interview with Tim DeChristopher. In a disputed auction of oil leases, Tim bid and won the rights to 22,000 acres, which he had no plan to pay for or exploit. He was tried on federal felony charges and served 21 months in prison. I offer this example of civil disobedience to remind us of the personal courage we may need to call on in this time of resistance.
What would you do? The BLM is holding an oil and gas lease auction where pristine Utah lands are up for bid. What would you do? You're asked if you're there for the auction, asked if you're a bidder. What would you say? You end up with a paddle. You bid. You win 12 leases in a row before the auction is halted. You're arrested, charged with felonies, and offered plea bargain deals if you will just apologize and express regret for your actions. What would you do? Well, on December 19, 2008, Tim DeChristopher disrupted a highly disputed BLM auction, effectively safeguarding thousands of acres of land. Not content to merely protest outside, Tim entered the auction hall and registered as bidder number 70. He outbid industry giants on land parcels, which, starting at $2 an acre, were adjacent to national treasures like Canyonlands National Park. He won 22,000 acres of land worth $1.7 million. 2 months later, incoming Interior Secretary Ken Salazar invalidated the entire auction. Yet DeChristopher was indicted and tried on 2 federal felonies and spent 21 months in prison. Released in April 2013, DeChristopher is the subject of a documentary film, Bidder 70, which opened this weekend at the Music Hall in Beverly Hills and other theaters around the country. He joins me this week to tell his story. What led him to that auction? What went through his mind as he began bidding and winning? Why didn't he take a plea deal? What was his experience in prison? And what message does he have for others? We'll also talk about the state of the movements to deal with energy, environment, and climate change in light of Obama's recent speech and the still-hanging-in-the-air decision of whether or not we will build the Keystone XL pipeline. I'll read one quote from Tim DeChristopher's statement to the court at his sentencing hearing. At this point of unimaginable threats on the horizon, this is what hope looks like. In these times of a morally bankrupt government that has sold out its principles, this is what patriotism looks like. With countless lives on the line, this is what love looks like, and it will only grow. Here on Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Tim DeChristopher is an environmental activist and founder of Peaceful Uprising, an organization dedicated to creating livable futures and empowering nonviolent action. He's best known for his act of civil disobedience, and which I just described. And DeChristopher spent 21 months in prison for his actions, as I said. He's a graduate of the University of Utah, and he will enter Harvard Divinity School in the fall of 2013. Welcome to Free Forum, Tim DeChristopher.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's really a pleasure. I've been following this since that auction made the news, and really enjoyed the film, Bidder 70. It's interesting how the film manages to generate out sort of from this incident into a lot more things for people to think about and stand up to. Now, I always like listeners, Tim, to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. Now, in your case, I think that you are very much the story we're talking about today. What moved you to take the actions you took, and how has taking those actions and experiencing those consequences impacted who you are and who you will be? You're 31 at the moment, right?
Right.
Okay. Now, I just did that quick bio, but could you tell us in your own words a bit about your path, and feel free to mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision?
Okay. Well, a lot of what put me in position to take this action was realizations that I was having over the course of 2008. In the years leading up to that, climate scientists were really realizing that a lot of their worst-case scenario projections were, in fact, overly optimistic. And so that was sinking into me a little bit later over the course of 2008. And I was seeing that what we were doing as a climate movement really wasn't working, certainly wasn't getting our government on board to take any action in response to this crisis. So I was building up the commitment that I needed to take that sort of action. I was also going through that period of despair that I see that a lot of climate activists have gone through, of realizing that in a lot of ways it was too late to prevent catastrophic climate change, and that we were heading down this path of a very rapid change. And so I had to go through that period of despair and come out of that with less hesitation, ready to take bold actions, and feeling to some degree that I had nothing to lose by taking actions and shaking things up. At the same time, I was studying social movement history and seeing the important role that civil disobedience has played in most of our successful social movements in this country's history, and the need to really challenge those in power to have confrontational strategies, not just to appeal to those in power, but to pressure those in power to actually change. And so all of that kind of put me in the mindset that I was in going into that auction in December of 2008, where I was ready to take bold action. And I didn't especially know exactly what that would look like, but I felt empowered to do something effective to stand in the way of what was going on in that auction. I saw that auction as a prime example of the drill now, think later mentality that was really driving our climate crisis. And so I saw it as as good of an opportunity as any to take a stand. And so that's my mindset going into that point.
Okay, I want to, because in that moment, as you say, you came more willing than ever to take bold action and not sure what it would be, and here you are at this sort of choice point. I want to, just because the actions you took, I just remember I read the story in the your local weekly there, and the writer, it's a wonderful article, long article, but the writer ends up saying, you know, what he did I couldn't do, basically, is kind of the last line of his piece. And I think there's an awful lot of listeners out there that share many of your perceptions of what's going on, whether it's climate change or you know, other issues of justice and so on. And I'm curious what goes on in the individual human being that shifts them from one of the many who signs the petitions and so on to one who is willing to go to prison. So if you could, you were working in economics, correct? What sort of work were you doing in economics in college?
Well, I was studying at the University of Utah, which has one of the most progressive economics programs in the country, that teaches anything other than neoliberal economics. And, you know, so I was learning a lot about corporate influence of our government and how big corporations distort market economics and that sort of thing. And I was focusing, you know, my research that I was doing at the time was focusing on alternatives to the GDP,
mm-hmm.
So alternative measures to well-being. I saw that as one of the areas that was really distorting a lot of our policy, that we were making decisions based on supposed economic progress because it raised the GDP. The GDP was not measuring the things that most people actually valued.
Very good. Okay, this is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Tim DeChristopher about his act of civil disobedience in saving over 20,000 acres of pristine public lands in Utah and landing himself in prison for 21 months. The documentary Bitter 70, which tells his story, Open to this weekend at the Music Hall Theater in Beverly Hills and elsewhere around the country. And there will be screenings rolling out in cities where it doesn't get a theatrical run. There will be screenings rolling out. And to learn more, you can go to peacefuluprising.org. That's the group that Tim co-founded, peacefuluprising, one word, .org, or bitter70film, and that's the number 70. So it's bitter70film.com to learn more about the film. Okay, so that's what you – and how much you're a student at the University of Utah. How much of your time and attention is going to activism or environmental activism?
I would say a decent portion. I mean, I had made that commitment to take some kind of effective action like that well before the option. And, you know, showing up at a lot of different things – looking for an opportunity to be effective, showing up at hearings, at rallies and things like that, and generally going away feeling like I hadn't done anything worthwhile. And I just happened to show up at this one and see that opportunity. And that's part of why I was able to make a relatively quick decision to jump at that opportunity. Because I had showed up at many other things and left feeling frustrated, I think I was at a point where I was very ready to take that opportunity there.
Let me ask you to tell us about two conversations or events that happened, I believe, in the time leading up to this. One, a conversation you had with Terry Root, who's a PhD, who's a member of the IPCC, the intergovernmental body that has rendered its analysis of climate change for years, and you at one point have a conversation with her.
Yeah, that was in early 2008. Terry Root was one of the Nobel Prize winners, who just the year before had won the Nobel Prize for her work on climate change. And I talked to her after a presentation that she gave, and I asked her about some of the charts and things that she was showing. That didn't present any scenario in which we reduce carbon emissions in time frame necessary to avoid key tipping points. And I talked to her about that afterwards, and she said, well, you're not missing anything. There was no scenario that we could come up with where we avoided all those worst-case consequences that we've been talking about. She said there were things we could have done in the 80s and things we could have done in the 90s, but now it's most likely too late. And she literally put her hand on my shoulder and said, I'm sorry, my generation failed yours. And that was pretty shattering for the position that I was in at the time. I mean, I had been doing a lot of research up until that point. So, you know, I think I was in a position where I could understand what she was saying. But it was still very shattering to me to have a Nobel Prize winner tell me that my future was so bleak. And that's part of what pushed me into that period of despair that I was talking about mm-hmm. earlier. And I think that's, you know, why I was able to engage in the level of activism that I was afterwards, mm-hmm. Because I'd already been through that despair. You know, what I see from a lot of other activists that are, you know, signing the petitions and that sort of thing, it seems like they're spending the majority of their emotional and intellectual energy trying to avoid that despair. They're trying to grasp at any straws that they can that are going to give them the hope that things are going to be able to stay the same.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, you also mention a speech that you heard Naomi Klein give at Bioneers, and Bioneers has been an annual fixture on this show. Kenny Azabel and some of the speakers, I have them on like almost every year, a few weeks before the conference. So I it was interesting for me to see that, you know, that was another pivotal moment. Tell us about that.
You know, that was for the speech that she gave in the fall of 2008. It was just before Obama was elected, but after McCain's campaign had pretty much imploded, so it was a given at that point that Obama was going to be elected. And she was kind of going through the reality of the situation that we were in with climate change and the promises that Obama was making in his campaign. and showing that even his best promises, which of course he hasn't come close to living up to, even those promises were not in line with what was actually necessary to turn things around on climate change. And she talked about why Obama was taking the positions that he was, because he's somebody who has found success by finding the center and going there, and that's his political MO, and that's probably not going to change. That Obama is a centrist. If you look at his history, he's somebody who finds the center and goes there. And she wrapped up the speech by saying that so if what Obama is talking about is not nearly good enough on climate change, and he is a centrist, and where he's at is the center, then what we need to do is we need to shift the center. And that was such a significant speech for me and a lot of the other local folks who heard that here in Salt Lake. We hosted a re-screening of that speech about a month after Bioneers at our local Unitarian Church and had a discussion group along with that where we talked about what it means to shift the center. And one of the things that came out of that for me and along with my thinking on social movements was that you can't shift the center from the center, that it's like rebalancing a scale. Adding more weight onto the center isn't going to shift anything. That to shift the balance of a scale, you need to go to the edges and shift the balance there. That we need to go to the edge of what's considered reasonable and push the boundaries, and that's how the center shifts. That's certainly something that conservatives understand very well.
Exactly. As you were saying that, I definitely heard how that's a playbook that they have followed since the 70s.
Absolutely. Part of the reason that we've regressed for the past 30 years or so on so many progressive issues is that while conservatives have continually pushed those boundaries and taken positions which, when they were first taken, seemed absurd and unreasonable, they continually pushed the boundaries to push the center to the right at the same time that progressives stopped pushing the boundaries in any way. Progressives started thinking in a very short-term way of saying, what kind of rhetoric is going to be necessary to win this short-term battle right now? And saying whatever was necessary for that, even if it was right-wing ideology that was going to get this particular bill passed, that's what they were doing. And we had no cohesive worldview coming out of the left. And so the center continually moved farther and farther to the right with our political system.
Very, very, very good. This is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. It's the voice of Tim DeChristopher. His courageous act of civil disobedience, which led to a prison term on federal felonies, is the subject of a documentary, Bitter 70, which opened this past weekend at the Music Hall Theater in Beverly Hills and elsewhere around the country. You can learn more at peacefuluprising.org and bitter70film.com. Okay, so now I hear we've got Naomi's speech, Climate Bioneers, that's mid-October. A month later, you play that speech. Now we're talking mid-November. So let's take ourselves up to December 19th, 2008, a month later. Your appearance at the auction part of an organized action of Peaceful Uprising? How many of you were there? What was the plan?
Peaceful Uprising didn't exist at the time. Peaceful Uprising was formed in early 2009 after I disrupted the auction. There was a protest happening outside that was organized by the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance. And I was planning on showing up to that, but also planning on going farther than just holding a sign out on the sidewalk. Before I arrived, I'd made the commitment that I was going to do whatever I could to try to stand in the way of this auction and draw more attention to the corruption that was going on there. I decided that I was going to try to get inside and cause some sort of a disruption. And I didn't know exactly what that might look like maybe making a speech or yelling something. But then when I walked in, the officials said, "Hi, are you here to be a bidder?" And I said, well, yes, I am. Still thinking that signing up to be a bidder would be how I could get inside and cause some kind of disruption. And it wasn't until I got inside the auction room and saw how things were working and saw that, you know, they'd given me this bid card. And with that, I could actually have a significant impact on what was going on. And I could do more than make a symbolic statement, but I could directly stand in the way of what was happening at the same time that I made a symbolic statement.
Very good. Give us a little bit, Tim DeChrister, give us a little bit of background on that auction. It was disputed, I believe, even at the time that it was taking place. It was later invalidated by Ken Salazar after he came in as the Interior Secretary under Obama. What was the situation leading up to that auction?
Yeah, there was a lot of controversy surrounding that auction because it was a confluence of not only the issues around climate change and energy development, but also public land use, which is a very big deal here in Utah. These were lands that were right outside of Canyonlands and Archer's National Parks, and also a lot of issues about the lack of a transparent democracy because the public was largely locked out of decision-making regarding public lands. This auction in particular was an anomaly, even though these auctions are held on a regular basis. This one was the result of an 8-year process of the Bush administration to rewrite the long-term resource management plans that govern how a large body of the Bureau of Land Management land is going to be used. And these were lands that had always been considered off-limits for energy development. And so the Bush administration spent the whole 8 years rewriting those plans to allow areas like this to be developed. And the auction had actually been delayed to allow those new plans to go into effect so that they could have one last auction under the Bush administration before a new administration came in where all these lands were allowed. So it was a very big auction, much bigger than normal, and in areas much more environmentally sensitive and culturally sensitive than had been allowed before. So there was all that controversy surrounding it. There were a lot of critiques because they weren't following some of their normal rules, like notifying the national parks and doing adequate environmental impact statements. To me, the most pressing of those rules that they weren't following was a law that went into effect in 2001 requiring the Bureau of Land Management and all the other agencies in the Department of the Interior to weigh the impacts of climate change with all the major decisions that they made, particularly with resource development.
Okay.
And that law was completely ignored throughout the Bush administration.
Yeah, see, I hadn't noticed kind of the essence of that December 19th, 2008 date, but that's it, isn't it? That we've already, the elections was a month ago, and then the inauguration will be less than a month or a month or so in the future, and so this is a last bit of business before they walk out the door. That's the voice of Tim DeChrister. We're talking about his actions on that date, December 19, 2008, and the consequences and the meaning, all laid out in the documentary film Bidder 70, which has opened in Los Angeles and other places around the country recently, and will kind of roll out in theaters and in independent screenings over the next over the next coming months. So you're sitting there, you've got a bidding paddle. My guess is you don't bid on the first parcel. At what point do you raise your hand and start bidding?
Well, I actually started bidding without winning any parcels originally. The parcels were going for around $10 or $12 an acre. Some of them were going for as little as $2 an acre. And so I started originally just to drive up the prices. And I would wait for it to get down to one bidder where it was going once, going twice. And then I'd jump in and start driving the price up and get out before I won anything. And that was being effective. I mean, some of them they would be going once, going twice at $15 an acre. And then I would jump in and drive them up to $240 an acre. And somebody else was winning the parcel at $240 an acre rather than $15. So I was being effective in that way.
You were at least making them pay a bit more for what they were doing. And then when does it change?
Well, I mean, I was seeing that, you know, the oil industry knew that these parcels were worth an order of magnitude more than they were paying for them. But it was still worth their while to buy them. So I knew that those were resources that were still going to be exploited. and as long as they were, as long as the oil industry was still winning those parcels, it was obviously still a good deal for them.
That's right. What I get from what you're saying is the higher they're willing to pay, the more likely they're going to drill.
Right. So I decided I had to go all in and actually start winning parcels. I went there with the mindset of doing a protest, of being disruptive. So I wasn't really being very subtle. And I started winning every single parcel, one after another. And I won 14 in a row and was making it pretty clear that I was there as an act of protest, before they finally stopped the auction, took me out, and some law enforcement agents then began questioning me. And I was very open with them, about telling them, what I was doing and why I felt like this was necessary, in the face of, our government's disregard for the rule of law, and lack of action on the climate crisis.
Okay, again, getting into your personal, what goes on inside the individual human, when you shift from driving up the price to winning the bids, there must be something going on another track in your brain about how the consequences, the potential consequences for you, have just shifted as well. What is going on inside of you at that moment?
Well, internal dialogue about the consequences was something that was going on while I was driving up the prices. I knew that if I started winning parcels, that I would likely be prosecuted. I would probably go to jail for a couple of years. So I was building the commitment to be okay with those consequences. There was kind of that tension of whether or not those consequences were worth it at that time, and I made the decision that they were, which is why I continued going forward. Once I made that shift of actually going all out and winning parcels, that's when a lot of that internal tension really disappeared, and there was a real feeling of calm that came over me at that point, where I knew that I had chosen my path, and I knew that it was too late to turn back. And I was very comfortable with that. That was a very peaceful moment, actually, when I was winning all those parcels.
That's an interesting phenomenon. I'm sure it surprised you even at that moment. That feeling of calm comes over you. Does that stay with you when you're taken away, when you're arrested, when suddenly the actual consequences start taking place, that feeling stays strong?
Yeah, it really has, and continues to. Edward Abbey once said that sentiment without action is the ruin of the soul, and I think I'd been feeling that tension up until that point, where I knew there was this massive crisis that we were facing, and my action in response to that was signing petitions and riding my bike and things like that. And I knew that my action was not in line with my sentiment, because my activism was not to the scale of the climate crisis. And once I went all in, I think that was the first time that my action was in line with my sentiment. And I found that the inverse of what Abby was saying was also true, that action in line with our sentiment is the salvation of the soul. And I felt that kind of internal healing immediately, and have continued to feel that as I went through the process, including when I was in prison. I can really say that internally I was more at peace during that time than I was during that time before the auction, when I knew that stronger action was necessary, but I was too afraid to take it.
That's a very powerful statement. This is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Tim DeChristopher about his act of civil disobedience that saved over 20,000 acres of pristine public lands in Utah and landed him in prison for 21 months. The documentary Bitter 70, which tells his story, opened this weekend at the Music Hall Theater in Beverly Hills and elsewhere around the country, and will continue to roll out in theaters and in private screenings over the next few months. To learn more, go to Peaceful Uprising, one word, peacefuluprising.org, an organization that Tim's a co-founder of after his actions at that auction, or Bitter 70 film, one word, bitter70film.com.
This is Terrence McNally. You're listening to my June 2013 conversation with Tim DeChristopher about his courageous acts of civil disobedience, for which he served 21 months in prison.
Okay, so now we're in the process where you have been arrested, you've been charged. What did you learn about the justice system in the course of your preparation for your trial that you hadn't known before?
Well, I learned a lot about the huge evolution of our justice system to minimize the role of the jury and the role of normal citizens in the process and to concentrate power in the hands of government officials, in the hands of judges and prosecutors. And I certainly saw that in action in my case, in addition to the research that I was doing about how commonplace that's become. The first thing that happened in my case was the prosecution filed a motion to limit my defense and say that I couldn't make any arguments about climate change, I couldn't make any arguments about the corruption of the government, or make the general argument called the necessity defense, which is the argument that I acted out of a necessity to prevent a greater harm. And the judge ended up siding with the prosecution on that, which severely curtailed what I was able to argue in my own defense. And then, you know, the result of that was that during my trial, we weren't able to tell the jury a lot of key parts of this story. We weren't able to tell the jury the fact that there had been about 25 other people in the few years before me who had won parcels and not paid for them, and none of them were prosecuted because they were all within the oil industry. We weren't able to talk
about that. By the way, that's the selective prosecution defense, that one that
right.
Other people commit the same act, basically. They're not prosecuted. This is obviously selective prosecution. That wasn't allowed. Go ahead.
Right. We also weren't able to talk about climate change. And most importantly, we weren't able to talk about the fact that this auction was later overturned because the government admitted that they weren't following their own laws. And, you know, there was we revisited that issue during the trial when the government had presented a witness who talked all about the laws that the government had to follow in holding this auction and the steps that they went through. And we wanted to be able to cross-examine to talk about the laws that they didn't follow, and the regulations that were in place that this official hadn't mentioned, which were largely ignored. And the judge ruled that that to talk about the government breaking laws would confuse the jury. And the judge had this very disrespectful view of ordinary people participating in the legal process. And you know, that's really a huge perversion from the view that our founding fathers had when they set up our legal system with juries as the foundation of that entire process. You know, the people who created our system were very adamant that the jury should be the most important and the most powerful player in the courtroom because the role of the jury was to protect our fellow citizens from the government. And people have largely forgotten that that's why we have juries. And so their role has been minimized to the point that not only are they not given information, but they're misled by judges and prosecutors into what their role is and the power that they have. And that's something that I saw, you know, was certainly not unusual with my case. You know, once I got incarcerated, and started talking to all the other people who were locked up, you know, I saw that the injustice on display in my case was certainly not unusual. It was the status quo.
Very good. Let me come in just for a second on that. Now, what it leads me to think, Tim, and I have a feeling that it might be the same for you, that originally this seems to be a story about the environment, climate change, and civil disobedience, but there's almost an equally important story about the perversion of the justice system in America. And let me just recommend to listeners a book by Amy Bach called Ordinary Injustice. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but she went around the country and looked at basically the way the system has evolved. And she, one of her contentions, I've got, there's a podcast of an hour interview with her on my website. What she found was that the system is not designed to handle jury trials, that given the current capacity of the system and the number of arrests, et cetera, that would be impossible. It is totally designed for everyone to settle, for everyone to plea bargain. And in fact, this is something that I think you allude to, too, is that those people who insist on a trial, who resist the efforts to go along with the system, that their sentence, that will probably impact their sentencing, and they will they are very likely to get harsher sentences if found guilty because they have demanded what the founding fathers promised.
Yeah, and that's something that's taken for granted by almost everyone within our legal system. You know, even defense attorneys will tell their clients right off the bat that if they take it to trial, that they'll get a much, much longer sentence. I mean, anywhere from twice to 10 times longer. You know, in my case, I was offered a plea bargain of 30 days and ended up with a sentence of 24 months. And you know, that's about the scale that I saw with a lot of other folks. And, you know, so that essentially means that the right to a jury trial no longer exists. You know, we have the power to insist on a jury trial, but if you're punished for doing something, then it's not a right. You know, like, there's a lot of things that we have the power to do that we'll be severely punished for.
Right.
Those are not rights. Those are crimes. And basically, jury trials are treated the same way by our legal system now. That, yes, you can do a jury trial, but you will serve much, much longer in prison than you otherwise would.
And as you've pointed out, that the chances of your being found innocent are going to be vastly compromised by the instructions by the judge and by what is disallowed and so on, so that you know, it's not only if found guilty will you be more harshly sentenced, but whatever thoughts you had that a jury would see your point or a jury would see things your way is definitely in the minority.
Yeah, and even the people who end up on the jury probably aren't going to be familiar with what their job is.
That's right.
And the power that they have as a jury, because jury trials are so rare.
Tell us about the scene, Tim, where the prosecution and the judge found out that the jury pool had gotten a pamphlet.
Yeah. It was during the jury selection process. The prosecution and the judge found out that most of the potential jurors had received a pamphlet before they came in on the first day out on the street. From the Fully Informed Jurors Association, which is a group that's based out of Montana. And it was a pamphlet that didn't talk anything about my case, but it talked about juries' rights and why we have juries, what the role of a jury is. And it talked about juries being the conscience of the community. And the prosecution really lost it at this point. It was the only time I saw the prosecutor completely flip out in the whole process. And we had to go into the judge's chambers, And the prosecutor was demanding a mistrial and wanted to get rid of the entire jury pool. He said this notion of jurors voting their conscience is just insane. And he was terrified at the notion that jurors had been given this pamphlet and thought that now they could use their conscience. And rather than declare a mistrial, the judge called each juror one at a time into his chambers. And I was in there with my legal team. The prosecution was in there, and the judge was at the head of the table. And to each individual juror, he would say, "You understand? You need to disregard everything that's in that pamphlet, because your job is not to decide what's right or wrong. Your job is to listen to what I say. The law says, and you have to enforce it, even if you think it's morally wrong. Can you do that? Can you do what I ask you to do, even if you think it's morally wrong?" And unless they said yes, they weren't on the jury. But I sat there and watched one juror after another say, "Yes, Your Honor, I'll do whatever you tell me to do, even if I think it's morally wrong." And that was really the moment when I knew that I was going to be convicted. I think that was probably the most significant point in the entire legal process that I went through. was that moment in the judge's chambers, where one person after another said that they would follow any instructions of the judge, even if they think it's morally wrong. And that's an extreme perversion of what the intended role of the jury is supposed to be and the way that our system is supposed to work.
Right. When I think of the Founding Fathers, on the one hand, they are standing up against the King Georges, but on the other hand, they're standing up against, if you will, the sheriffs of Nottingham, right? The rule that that citizens were not, you know, did not have standing when it came to the law, that only, you know, those with power and money and so on, and that the founders were saying, no, in this country it will be different.
Right. And, you know, the country was formed, you know, by leaders who were skeptical and fearful of the concentration of power. But obviously, as the country has evolved, those in power have a greater and greater interest in concentrating power, you know, which it might be why Thomas Jefferson said that every generation needs its own revolution, so that we can get back to that perspective that the concentration of power is a dangerous thing. You know, because what I saw when I watched one after another person say that they would follow any instructions of this authority figure, even if they thought it was morally wrong, you know, that was when I saw how some of the great atrocities in history could be possible, how mm-hmm. things like a genocide or a Holocaust could be possible when the mass of citizens think that it's not their job to decide what's right or wrong and that they have to let go of their own moral authority in the face of some elected official. You know, that to me is a very scary proposition. But on the other hand, I saw the fear that the prosecutor had. You know, this was the United States attorney. He represented the United States of America and had that full power and force behind him. And yet he felt like all that power could be undermined by citizens exercising their conscience and holding on to their own moral authority when exercising their civic duties. You know, so I saw this this huge dichotomy hinging on the power of conscience.
Yeah.
And whether or not people had faith in their own moral authority.
Yeah. This is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. That's Tim DeChristopher. We're talking about his actions that are, you will see in the documentary Bitter 70, which is in theaters now and will continue to roll out across the country over the next year. Then you are so one of the things is you are offered plea bargains and you consistently refuse them because you want to be judged by a jury of your peers. It's only when you get when you've made that choice and you are in scenes like the one you just described that you find out that your chances of that jury actually being your peers and acting like your peers and acting their conscience and so on has disappeared. Let's skip now to prison. It becomes somewhat inevitable, as you say, from that moment on and the things that you're not able to deal with and so on sort of ensure your conviction. Talk a little bit about your statement at the sentencing hearing.
Yeah, the sentencing hearing was the first time that I was able to speak freely in the courtroom. And, you know, of course, the jury was well out of the picture by this point. And you know, the judge was the only deciding factor in the room once I was able to speak freely. But I still felt like it was important to take that opportunity and explain what I was doing and why and how that fit into a larger context. So I spoke for quite a while there. And I explained, you know, what I was doing. I contradicted some of the points that the prosecution had been making in their sentencing arguments that I felt were misleading. And I also tried to explain the role of civil disobedience. You know, the prosecution made this statement in some of their arguments that this is a country founded on the rule of law, not on civil disobedience. And so I made the case that those two are not that far apart, that that this is a country founded on civil disobedience, as most of our founding fathers engaged in civil disobedience, and that's where our country originated. but it also throughout our history, civil disobedience has played the role of aligning our rule of law with the shared values of our population, and that whenever the rule of law has been out of line, out of alignment with our shared values, it's been civil disobedience that has drawn the two back together. And that was the role that I was engaging in, and I felt like this was one of those situations where the government was no longer representing the people because it had been corrupted by the influence of corporations and a small moneyed minority that was able to write a lot of our laws and avoid prosecution themselves for their massive crimes against the people. And I felt like this was a time for civil disobedience. And I told the judge that, you know, based on the corruption in our country and the injustice that we're looking at, this wouldn't be the last civil disobedience that I engaged in. That not only did I not regret my actions, but I expected to do something similar in the future, and nothing he was going to do in the sentencing was going to discourage that, and it wasn't going to discourage the people who had been inspired by my actions either, that it wasn't going to scare anyone else into obedience, which the judge and the prosecutor had already indicated very clearly was their primary goal.
Their primary goal in the sentencing. Their first goal is to make sure you are convicted. And then in the sentencing, given the latitude they give, you at one point say, you know, they could have given you community service. They could have respected that you were not a criminal but a civil disobedient citizen and so on. And that they actually, you have statements where they indicate that the reason for a healthy sentence, a two-year sentence in federal prison, is to discourage others. And as you say, in your speech, in your speech at that sentencing hearing, you say that won't work. let me read the quote that actually opens the film, which is from a Martin Luther King letter from Birmingham jail. "One who breaks an unjust law must do so openly, lovingly, and with a willingness to accept the penalty." He goes on, "I submit that an individual who breaks a law that conscience tells him is unjust and who willingly accepts the penalty of imprisonment in order to arouse the conscience of the community over its injustice is in reality expressing the highest respect for law."
Yeah, and that's certainly the way that I felt at the time. You know, even the sentencing guidelines, I mean, by the legal standard, the way that the sentencing guidelines applied to my case as prepared by the civil servants in the Justice Department, that recommended probation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, according to the rule of law, if you want to use that term, according to the rule of law, the appropriate sentence for me would have been probation. And the judge threw out that report. He threw out the sentencing guidelines, and he said he wasn't going to abide by those. And his reason that he gave for that was the public statements that I had continued to make since the time of the auction, where I spoke out about the corruption of the government, and I spoke out about the need for civil disobedience and the continued threat of climate change. The judge made it very clear. He said that my actions weren't really that big of a deal, but my continuing trail of statements was why I needed to be imprisoned.
Right. In other words, your legal free speech was what, in his mind, dictated your sentencing.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And he said that in no uncertain terms.
Yeah. So let's talk just a little bit about prison. David Harris, another practitioner of civil disobedience during the Vietnam War, he's quoted in the film saying, "They've got your body, no doubt about it, but they only get your mind if you give it to them." What was your experience like in prison? You have a couple of minutes.
Yeah, you know, the people that they feature in the film were in prison a generation ago when, frankly, we had an extremely different justice system than we do today. You know, and one of the consequences of mass incarceration is that our prisons are filled with pretty normal people. So my experience in prison wasn't really that bad at all. It was an environment that naturally lends itself to introspection, you know, and my days were made up with walking and exercising and reading and having conversations with people. So it was certainly a learning experience for me, where I saw a different sort of population, one that's really the most oppressed in our society. And it was an experience that I think will impact my activism moving forward, and an experience that overall I'm actually grateful for.
Yeah, that's the remarkable thing. I've seen, you know, obviously in preparing for this, I looked at a number of interviews, and you are consistently asked about that, and you actually say grateful for the experience of prison. You had studied economics, and we talked about what you'd studied. You are going to attend Harvard Divinity School this fall. How did your decision to apply, and, how did that evolve, and what do you plan to study?
My plan for going to divinity school is to become a Unitarian Universalist minister. And that was something that I was leaning towards during that period between the auction and when I got incarcerated, when I was basically a full-time activist during that time. And I got pretty disillusioned with professional activism. I saw that the world of professional activism tended to funnel people into a narrow slice of an issue, and I felt like my perspective was more looking at things holistically and articulating a bigger vision. And I saw that even a lot of the professional activists that I knew that shared my ideas didn't feel like they could speak honestly and openly about those in their role as an activist. And I saw that the person who was closest to doing that was actually my minister at my local church in Salt Lake City. And so I started seriously pursuing it during that time and saw that more and more what was holding us back was some sort of spiritual issue. As I said with what happened in the sentencing or the jury selection process, I saw the power of conscience, that whether or not people had faith in their own moral authority was this huge factor. That had a huge influence on where we were going and whether or not we were going to be turned against each other or turned towards each other.
Very good. If I give you a final word, what would that be if you were talking about what you see calling on all of us moving forward, whether it's people in peaceful uprising, people who end up in your Unitarian congregation, etc.?
When we look at the crises that we're facing, there are things that we can learn from social movement history about how to pressure those in power. But the truth is that nobody really has the answers about what we need to do right now. No one has ever solved a climate crisis before. No one has ever overthrown corporate power to the degree that we need to. And so we need a lot of creativity, a lot of people pushing the boundaries, taking risks and making sacrifices. And that's probably not going to come from the established NGOs that we look to for leadership. I think that's going to have to come from people acting out of their own conscience. But I think the thing that can be learned from my story is that when people do take that kind of action and do put themselves in that position, this is really a movement that holds people, that supports people, that amplifies our voices. Even if we take action on our own, we have this movement that amplifies our voices and makes sure that our actions resonate to a larger audience and also holds us and supports us as we go through that whole process. That's what I saw, even when I was in prison and getting dozens of letters every day. This is truly a movement that is there to hold people if we're ready to take those risks.
I hear that it's an individual who must make the decision, the choice to go further than they've gone or to be bolder than they've been. But you're saying that once one does that, there is a movement that will hold you and support you.
Yeah, that it'll take individuals to cross that line, but they should cross it knowing that they're not just an isolated individual, but they are part of this bigger movement that can be powerful against these entrenched institutions, and they will hold them as they go through this this period.
Very good. And I don't have time to go into it, but it does seem to me that what's been happening with 350 org, and even the Sierra Club, I think, was committed civil disobedience for the first time in trying to close down some coal plants recently, and the fight against Keystone. It does seem to me that people are beginning to become a bit bolder.
Yeah, you know, the climate movement today looks radically different than it did just 4 years ago, and I think there's a lot of factors for that, but it's encouraging to see. You know, we still have farther to go. But, you know, we're seeing results from that already.
Exactly.
And I think, you know, if we continue pushing in that direction, we're going to find that we're a lot more powerful than we ever expected.
Very good. The documentary Bitter 70, which tells the story of Tim DeChristopher's courageous acts to save pristine public lands from oil and gas leases, opened this weekend at the Music Hall Theater in Beverly Hills and elsewhere around the country. To learn more, you can go to Peaceful Uprising, one word, peacefuluprising.org, that's Tim's organization, or bitter70film.com, the website for the film. Thank you, Tim DeChristopher, and keep up your good work.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Come, let me recommend two things. One that I mentioned during the course of the show, which was Amy Bach's book, Ordinary Injustice. If you want to learn about what has happened to our justice system across the board, not in isolated big trials or anything, Amy Bach, B-A-C-H, Ordinary Injustice. And there's a documentary that's in theaters now, and if you miss it in theaters, it'll be available, you know, in those other venues of where you can rent it and so on. A movie on Hannah Arendt. And Hannah Arendt was an intellectual who attended the Eichmann trial, and she was the first one to talk about the banality of evil, which is all those jurors coming forward and saying, I will do what you say, even if it goes against my moral judgment. This week's conversation, many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, and you can join me in pursuit of a world that just might work at my website, terrencemcnally.net. That's TerrenceMcNally, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcements of upcoming guests and issues, you can sign up at my site, or you can email me at TEMcNally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to Free Forum podcast on iTunes. Thanks to G, my engineer, to Stan Mizrahi in production, and to you, my listeners. I look forward to being with you again next week.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. Anti-union legislation has failed to pass in New Hampshire's state assembly. The bill would have prevented workers from deciding to put a requirement to pay union dues in their labor contracts. New Hampshire Professional Firefighters President Bill McQuillan told WMUR-TV Thursday it's a win for New Hampshire families.
We're feeling very good about what happened today, and I think this is a victory for all in the middle class in this state today.
New Hampshire AFL-CIO President Glenn Brackett.
I consider that a victory for working families in New Hampshire.
UAW President Dennis Williams says he's disappointed that South Carolina Boeing workers opted to vote against being represented by a union in the IAM vote this week, and he's really dissatisfied with Boeing over the harsh anti-union campaign in South Carolina.
I am disappointed in Boeing because we represent some Boeing facilities and we have a good relationship. So I will be having conversation with those people who meet with Boeing to tell them our dissatisfaction. And you can't say to me in California that you want to have a partnership in a relationship and then go stab me in Carolina. The relationships like that usually get divorces.
Williams spoke out on a number of different issues Thursday in a wide-ranging discussion with reporters in Detroit. I asked him if he thinks the building trades unions meeting with Trump will divide or weaken the labor movement.
I don't think it divides us. The building trades are after jobs. If Congress would have passed the infrastructure bill a long time ago, they would have been very supportive. And I think that's where the building trades fit at. I don't think it's about they're going to go ahead and walk away from the labor movement because they had a meeting with President Trump. They're looking at the interests of their membership when it comes to jobs. I don't believe Sullivan or any of them guys are going to walk away from the labor movement just because Trump invited them to the White House.
Alexandra Acosta is Trump's latest labor secretary nominee after the spectacular fail of original nominee Andy Puzder. The Fight for 15 workers movement, which opposed Puzder with nationwide demonstrations, says no matter who is labor secretary, workers will not back down. Fight for 15 says it won't stop the movement until workers win $15 an hour, and a union.
Sponsored by Iron Workers Impact, now reserving spots for this year's groundbreaking conference, welcoming contractors to grow their business by networking and attending world-class breakouts. More on this event in San Diego, happening March 19th through the 22nd, is found online at impact-net.org under Events. Workers Independent News is proud to be heard on The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio. Live nationwide weekdays, noon to 3 p.m. at theunionedge.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.